There is an ancient legend that says everything wasted on Earth is treasured on the moon. Do you have any misspent time, unfilled desires? If so, come along with Mind's Eye Radio as we take a journey to the moon. Welcome to Moonglow on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Cole Hornaday. Mind's Eye Radio is a program tuned to the sounds of social change. It is written and produced by the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. In this hour, we'll visit the moon through songs, poems, stories, and legends. Join us, won't you? Do you recall the first stories you were told about the moon? Tales of gods and goddesses, green cheese, or perhaps a cow that jumped over the moon. If you grew up in Singapore, you probably would have heard a fairy tale about a princess, as told here by Charlotte Quo Benitez.
Long before Neil Armstrong made his small step for man, a young Chinese woman had already placed her brocade-slippered feet upon the moon's cratered surface. How did she get there? Is she still there? I'm talking about the Chinese empress-turned-goddess Chang'e and of her flight to the moon eons before the attempts of white men. The story goes that a long, long time ago, there existed 12 suns in the sky to warm the earth. This was too much for humankind, and people began thinking of a solution to literally beat the heat. Finally, after many town hall meetings and council gatherings, a young man decided to take matters into his own hands. Arming himself with some bows and arrows, he climbed up the highest mountain and began to shoot the suns down one by one. By some accounts, he was a sharpshooter and, fortunately for future generations of humans, smart enough to leave one sun burning in the sky. He could also very well have had a couple of lucky shots and then simply run out of arrows. But who am I to dispute the historical record? It's not like anybody else has tried to shoot down the sun and succeeded. This guy with the arrows, whose name was Ho Yi, became such an overnight hero that the people unanimously crowned him emperor. Being the emperor had its perks, one of which was that he got to choose the most beautiful and accomplished woman in the land to be his wife, and her name was Chang'e. Now, either Ho Yi wasn't such a terrific guy to begin with, or else absolute power corrupts absolutely. Whichever the case, it didn't take long for the young ruler to become obsessed with the idea of ruling forever. He sent ships out into the four seas, filled with explorers looking for an elixir of immortality. They never came back, afraid of being put to death for their failure to fetch the elusive potion. Some people say they became the original founders of Japan and Korea. In the meantime, Ho Yi fretted and primped, and his people suffered from his poor leadership and lack of vision. There was poverty, famine, drought. Race relations were bad. War broke out. Unlucky embassies were destroyed and innocent bystanders killed for no reason. Young people were shooting arrows at each other, left and right. Fortunately, this is now all history. One fated day, an extraordinary thing happened. Some of the explorers returned with the elixir of immortality. Ho Yi couldn't believe his luck. He could hardly contain himself as the instructions were carefully related to him. 1 to 2 teaspoons 3 times a day for 10 days. As he prepared himself for the first momentous dose, Chang'e tried to talk him out of it. After all, it was an experimental drug, who knew what the side effects were, and so on and so forth. But to no avail. As she listened to him go on and on about eternal youth, or at least eternal life, she realized that the only way to release her people from their suffering was to get rid of the dangerous drug, thus ensuring that he would, eventually, keel over and die. I don't know why Chang'e didn't just pour the stuff down the chamber pot. I couldn't tell you what possessed her to drink the whole dosage herself. Maybe he came upon her in the act and she panicked. Maybe the outhouse was occupied. Maybe she figured he'd kill her anyway, so she might as well poison herself and spare herself the agony. Regardless of her motivations, she swallowed the drug in one swift motion. What happened next was a miracle. Chang'e felt herself becoming lighter and lighter until she began floating right up into the night sky, higher and higher over rice fields, tiled rooftops, pagodas and temples, mountains and rivers. The people on earth became smaller and smaller until finally she couldn't see them anymore. All she could eventually see was a green and blue globe that was heartbreakingly beautiful from where she stood. Many, many centuries later, a fellow would build an immense wall that snaked around the earth for miles, and she would wonder what possessed him to do such an unusual thing. Had she known how many of her people died building the Great Wall, she would have wept in grief. But since she didn't know such things living on the moon, she enjoyed viewing it, for it reminded her of home. Did Neil Armstrong ever meet Chang'e? Did he, upon his trip to the moon, happen upon an immortal young woman, quick of wit and beautiful to boot? I like to think she invited him to sit and have tea with her, gossip a little about what was going on Earth. He might have shown her around his shuttle, and they could have compared notes on the domestic details involved in living a life in space. Perhaps he offered her a ride home, but she would have gestured to the moon and said, "This is my home now, and anyway, everybody I know is dead." The gallant white man would have taken his helmet off to her, if he could, and she would have gracefully curtsied as he took his leave. I like to think that that's what happened. That in a time and space of infinite tranquility and peace, two people met who were as different can be, and all they did was to marvel at the earth they shared. This is Charlotte Kuo Benitez for Mind's Eye Radio.
Astronaut Neil Armstrong has never confessed that he ran into a Chinese princess on the moon. But there's no doubt the Apollo journeys changed the way we view the moon and the Earth. Here's Sue Renard in her essay, Landscapes of the Moon.
Almost 100 years ago, French writer Marcel Proust said, "Only through art can we get outside ourselves and see landscapes which would have remained unknown to us, like the landscapes of the moon." Today, no one would dream of making that analogy because nearly every inch of the lunar landscape has been photographed. The first close-up photos were taken by a Russian satellite in 1959, but to my mind, our exploration of the moon's surface began for real on May 25, 1961.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
It's hard to remember now what it was like back in the 1960s. High tech meant having a small transistor radio playing top 40 songs. To a young school child, as I was then, the race to the moon was more real than most other events of the turbulent decade. We didn't stop class in first grade to watch news from Vietnam, but we did to see John Glenn rocket into orbit. We didn't interrupt sixth grade science to watch riots in Chicago, but we did to see the first Apollo launches. That's why I was so excited on July 20th, 1969.
Eagle looking great. Here go. Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent.
Auto descent.
Host control, both auto descent. Engine command override off.
You're off.
Engine arm off. 413 is in. We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, the Eagle has landed.
Nowadays, anyone can log onto the World Wide Web and download dozens of digital photos of moon landscapes. The pictures in my mind, however, are those grainy black and white TV images that the Apollo mission sent back to Earth across 250,000 miles of empty space. I can still recall the huge craters and the smooth seas we learned were formed by molten lava, all of them etched on a harsh lunar landscape. But what made an even bigger impression on many people were the photographs the astronauts took of the planet Earth. For the first time, we saw our own planet for what it is, a beautiful blue ball hanging in space, a world without borders. There are people who question our investment in space exploration, and I feel guilty that I'm not one of them. I know there are major problems here on Earth, but when I think back to the summer of 69 and watching Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and a starched American flag, it's hard for me to be cynical about the space program. And someday, I dream of having a telescope strong enough so I can locate the newest feature on the lunar landscape, those footprints left behind in the moon dust by that one small step 30 years ago.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Sue Renard.
Piano player Mark Sylar and guitarist Mike O'Connell with an original composition dedicated to the moon. In his 1852 journal, Henry David Thoreau wrote, "The youth gets together his materials to build a bridge to the moon. The middle-aged man builds a woodshed with them." Do you think you've lost sight of the moon's magic? Mark James von Karstedt thinks he has a cure.
Have you ever danced to a sultry moon? Late at night, when the moon rides high and full, take your shoes off. Let the moon's glow fall on your back and dance with your lover. Slow, methodical, rhythmic movements. Watch your shadow flow along the ground. Gently it plays with you, silhouetting your every move. The tempo releases through your gestures as your soul orchestrates primordial responses, which instinctively take over to express the imprint life has left on you. I imagine elders from ancient cultures would call this shadow dancing, for it mimics the energy of your inner spirit. I performed this ancient ritual for the first time high up on a cliff in central Wisconsin on a limestone ledge, near a great lake the Native Americans called Winnebago, or Smelly Water. I could feel the beat of the drums in every cell of my body. Doom, 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 doom. As my feet matched the pattern of the drums, the intensity grew and my arms flowed up and around, my torso lurched and reared, and my head tossed forward and back, twirling round and round. I was being guided by what felt like some ancestral place inside me I barely knew existed. The experience was heavenly. We laughed, chanted, until the sides of our faces and bellies ached. Then we gazed at the moon to give thanks and admire this celestial body which granted us such joy. Shadow dancing, by the light of that moon, cleared my mind and freed my spirit.
Dancing in the moonlight.
For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Mark James von Karstedt.
Jules Verne may not have been the first human to dream about going to the moon, but his classic story, From Earth to the Moon, published in 1865, started a long history of science fiction stories set on the lunar landscape. Listen to this passage, written by Greg Willard, of future history from the Galactic Geographic Website Journal.
By 2050, It was believed by some that a concordance of biotechnology, social change, and the rigors of life in artificial environments made lunar colonization a single-sex venture. Others would explain the all-female inhabitants of the moon as true to some atavistic power of the moon itself. From ancient times, the moon was a woman, its phases nearly matching the female menstrual cycle, its cool silver light opposed to the yellow glare of the masculine Apollo's sun. The discovery of a new energy source in 2097 settled the matter. The mystical forces won out, and the moon became an all-female domain. Strangely, the discovery had its beginnings with the 20th century Irish writer James Joyce and the birth of quantum physics, when it was noted that the presence of the observer affects the nature of the observed. Quarks, the basic wave-particle units of light in quantum mechanics, were named after a line of dialogue in James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. This was not, as it turned out, the meaningless whimsy of a bookish physicist. The Joyce quantum effect was the logical, if unanticipated, result, further inspired by a throwaway pun of Joyce's in 1947, when he called etymology, the study of word origins, etym-smashing. Vastly more powerful than atom-smashing, etym-smashing and the Joyce quantum effect yielded limitless and radiation-free amounts of energy through the smashing of sound waves. Some words, like apple or toothbrush, created no energy when smashed, but others unlocked energy far exceeding conventional atomics. Now, what words unleash the ultimate force? After computer analysis of all known words spoken in all known tonalities, researchers identified the energy core in the word moon and its many origins, the words uttered by a digital collage of 8 million female voices necessary to unleash the clean and limitless power for space travel. Words like menses, mania, lunacy, menoinen, meaning to meditate or wish. What was not understood was the gender-specific nature of the subatomic world. Pre-21st century technology was masculine. The original manned moon missions were named Apollo and used fossil fuels. But 21st century technology rapidly progressed into realms previously considered magical or mystical. Manipulation of gravity, matter, time, and dimensions were thus found to hinge on the power of special words spoken in a female voice. But the most startling effect was connected to the original understanding that quantum physics had revealed. The observer changes the observed. Now, this was first demonstrated when the original Apollo missions photographed the moon's surface. It was found to be smooth, blank, featureless, in a word, dull. But when the first Joyce quantum-powered ships piloted by females reached the moon, they found a magical landscape of jagged towering peaks, bottomless craters, fields of fissured crystal, canyons of spectral magma-heated mists. Men could see these sights only if the moon had a large female presence. Now, the commercial possibilities of a moon shaped by magic and mystery far outweighed the disappointment of the original moon landings. And so, today, the moon remains a world populated by women and governed by magic. This is Greg Willard with Mind's Eye Radio.
Otherwise, I'd be snuggling warm in bed.
Sounded like a wild animal.
Might be some beast the gypsies left behind.
It seemed to come from the churchyard.
Don't stand there talking. Let's go and see.
Then he will be.
Howling round your kitchen door. You better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again.
For most of human history, the moon was the ruler of the night sky. Now he must share the limelight with moons from other planets, rings and nebula, black holes and frozen planets. We wondered how the moon is taking this loss of stature and sent ace reporter Beatrice Montjoy to find out.
Beatrice Montjoy with Mind's Eye Radio. I'm here chatting with the moon. Moon, good day.
Hey, Beatrice.
We certainly appreciate your taking the time to visit with us.
Well, no one's come up to see me in a while, you know.
You'd like people to show more interest in you?
Yeah, well, you could do something about all those footprints you left on me.
Sorry to make you feel stepped on. Moon, you've held a prominent place in Earth's culture and mythology. Why do you think that is?
I don't see any other moons up here, do you?
It's a matter of default, then.
Sure. Everybody loves a moon.
Perhaps. One of the stranger moon myths is the belief that you are made of green cheese.
Okay. You know, there is just no truth to that. I don't know how these things get started. Frankly, it's a little disrespectful.
Not to worry, Moon. Nobody believes the green cheese story anymore, especially now that we've retrieved rocks from your surface.
Yeah, nice of you to ask for those.
Any other grievances you wish people to know about?
Well, it would be nice if people would call me something other than Moon.
And what would you like to be called?
Murray.
So you want people to talk about a half Murray, a waning Murray, etc.?
Well, not that so much. I mean that. If a couple's out walking around together some night, instead of saying, "What a lovely moon," or whatever, they could say, "Hey, Murray's looking good."
I see. Having been our natural satellite for so long, Moon, oh, I beg your pardon, Murray, do you think that people take you for granted?
Well, sometimes. But people write songs and poems about me and stuff. That's always cool.
It's nice to know that we bring you some satisfaction. I'd like to ask about your celestial counterparts. Shall we say, the sun?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the sun also has an important place in the heavens. In fact, what we call moonlight is actually the sun's light reflected off of you. Do you feel you're living in the sun's shadow?
Not at all. I mean, what's the sun do? Rise, set, that's pretty much it. Me, I've got phases, I control the tides and make eclipses. It's good to be the moon.
I see. As you look across the solar system at other planets and moons, what do you think makes you unique, Murray?
Unique?
Well, Saturn has rings, Mars has canals. What distinguishes you?
I'm Murray.
Of course you are. What does the future hold for Murray?
Well, I've got some blue moons planned, an eclipse. Nothing major. Well, nothing major these days, anyway. I try to live day by day, you know?
Indeed. Murray, thank you.
Hey, no problem.
We've been talking with Murray, the Moon. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Beatrice Montjoy.
Murray the Moon was played by Christian Newhouse, and Beatrice Montjoy played by Sue Renard. While the moon may not be as central to human life as it once was, Gay Davidson-Zilski finds herself humming popular moon tunes now and then and reminiscing about the old days.
Moon River picks up the scent of freshly waxed gymnasium floor as it sidles into the darker corners, and I feel Richie Jones's fingers dig into my lowest rib, just above the totally superfluous girdle part of the Playtex elastic garment I'm wearing for the very first time. Off to see the world! At the darkened edge of the room where I feel Richie sweating his starched white shirt transparent. Street shoes are not allowed on the gym floor, but some special dispensation has been given by Mr. Hicks, the principal for Social Club, and we slide and scrape in our patent plastics. There's such a lot of world to see. Outside Plum Thicket, Illinois. I know that now, but hanging on to Richie's shoulder, smelling the butch wax of his freshly pomaded hair, at the time made our flat spot in the much larger flat spot in the world seem pretty exotic. To drifters, drifting toward the doors. Drifter didn't have a pleasant connotation for me outside of this song, but drift we did, the scent of the tasseling corn and velvet weed languorous beyond the back-flung double doors. I don't know whether Richie and I were after the same rainbow's end. I thought he would probably follow his dream the whole half mile to his parents' prosperous farm, a farm so close to school he sometimes rode his pony, Star, to Social Club. This transportation surely would have put a crimp into the custom of parking with one's date, but the topic never came up. Waiting round the bend of the gravel road leading out of town were my dreams, too. My huckleberry friend, Moon River, and me.
Gay also took her fascination with Moon songs out to the streets of Madison to see if others shared her passion. She found many people did, but often only through the first line.
I'm being followed by a moon shadow, moon shadow, moon shadow. Skipping and jumping on a moon shadow, moon shadow, moon shadow.
Both sing.
Moon river, wider than a mile. I'm crossing you in style someday. In my heart. Without a love of my own. Blue moon.
That's all I know.
Shine on, shine on, harvest moon. I don't know the rest of the word.
I ain't had no love since
January, February, June, or July.
You're listening to Moonglow on Mind's Eye Radio. I'm your host, Cole Hornaday. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll hear about the moon chasing Venus and listen to original poems and classical music inspired by moonlight. Stay tuned. When the Earth is cloaked in moonlight, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between fantasy and reality. As recounted here in the short play, The Moon Chasing Venus, written by Dick Radke.
His Aunt Kate invites Robert to the Lake Geneva Pavilion for Junior League's benefit ball. In that place out of time, women float across the dance floor in formal gowns while their men strut like peacocks. Robert slips out onto the balcony for a breath of air. A woman stands at the rail, looking out at the lake. She is tall, slim as a young girl, swaying in time to the muted music.
Am I interrupting?
Oh, no. Just looking over there at my house.
You live here?
Over there, on the east shore, Geneva Bay.
My mother and father spent their summers up here during the 50s. This is like taking a peek into their youth.
Oh, wonderful times, the 50s.
I have a picture of them dressed in white linens, standing on this very balcony. They were struggling to make the rent on a three-room apartment, but in the picture they shine like royalty.
Love conquers all.
A silver sword of moonlight flashes across the glassy water. She wears a dress that Katharine Hepburn might have worn in Philadelphia's story. A puff of wind caresses her sleeve, then rises to play with a wisp of hair at her temple.
Do you believe in fate?
She smiles, and for the first time, he sees her face full on, washed in moonlight.
I believe that we have no idea of the breadth and depth of the world around us.
The unseen dimension.
Unseen, unheard, unfelt. a world too fine for our rough senses.
Science says the moon is craters made up of rocks and dust. They sent men in white suits to check it out. Turned out moon dust is nothing more than gray ash.
And what about the fun of it? The man on the moon, the green cheese of imagination. We look at the moon and see everything from true love to silver apples, and we live our lives by its phases.
So do the oceans. The moon pulls every drop of water in all the world's oceans toward itself, like magic.
Do you believe that the cow jumped over the moon?
Absolutely, and the dish ran away with the spoon.
The moon chasing Venus. Her lover pleads for an embrace, but she always runs just beyond his grasp. A gibbous moon chases Venus across the summer sky as mortals watch their dance with silken sigh.
Nice rhyme. Whose is it?
It's a bedtime poem my mother told me when I was a little girl. I have a picture of it here on my bracelet.
She holds her hand out to him and steps closer. He takes her hand in his. On her wrist, a band of gold reflects like glittering stars.
It's an interpretation of the poem. See, moon chases Venus while the stars in the heavens look on.
It's beautiful.
The bracelet is edged in gold rope, Venus represented by a small diamond, the moon by a cultured pearl. With a twist of her wrist, she slips the band from an ivory arm and holds the nursery rhyme out to him.
He really does, you know.
I'm sorry.
The moon chases Venus across the sky, never quite catching her and never quite giving up.
She moves closer to him, bringing the aroma of lilacs on the air. A pulse beats in the space between them. Her fingers touch his, and a charge illuminates them like the moon. She looks up, takes the bracelet back, places it on the balcony rail.
They're at it now, racing across the sky in an endless dance, reminding us of how tormenting love can be.
He never catches her, then.
Not so far.
The black silhouette of a powerboat cuts across the mirrored surface, slicing the moon in half. A moment later, an inboard engine growls like a lion in its sleep. She turns, faces the ballroom doors.
I must go now.
Wait, just a minute. Could we meet again?
She hesitates, begins a nod. Then she steps through the open doorway, her dress merging with the curtains that billow like smoke out onto the balcony. He takes one step toward the door, then stops. A glint of gold catches his eye, the bracelet lying on the stone barrier. He snatches it up and hurries back into the ballroom. He spies Aunt Kate near the punch bowl.
Did you see a woman in a pale cream dress come in from the balcony just now?
Why? What is it?
This. She forgot it. I'm trying to return it to her.
Oh, my God. Where did you get that? It's the bracelet that belongs to Nora Stevens. It's one of a kind.
Then you know her.
Oh, yes. She was my mother's best friend. When I was young, I heard the story many times of that bracelet. Her husband gave it to her in lieu of an engagement ring. Such an unusual thing to do.
Do you see her in the room?
Hardly. Nora Stevens is dead.
Tall, blonde, blue eyes, cream-colored dress?
That was the dress she wore the night she died.
Wait a minute. You're playing a joke on me.
No. The Nora Stevens case was a sensation. She went out to the balcony one night during a party. 5 minutes later, a scream was heard. She jumped, broke her neck on the rocks below. Autopsy showed that she was pregnant, and speculation was that she had a lover.
But what about the bracelet? It's hers. You said so yourself.
I don't know what to tell you, Robert. It's a mystery. All I am sure about is that Nora Stevens died in 1957, more than 40 years ago, and she died by her own hand.
His hand closes on the bracelet. He cranes his neck toward the balcony, knowing that he will see her again. They will face each other under a moon, covered over at intervals by cotton candy clouds. It will surely happen, if only in dreams.
The moon may be called the lesser light in the book of Genesis, but its tug on our imagination seems far greater than that of the sun. Here's poet Jackie Wilson with two poems written by the light of the moon.
Seascape. The full moon is a perfect pearl, tumbling on waves of clouds in an ocean of universe. Moonlight on a next-door roof. Escaped from streetlight's tyranny, the moon laces apparitional silver through a blue silk sky, creating spectral branches to mimic the real world. This is Jackie Wilson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Have you ever been in a strange place and looked up into the night sky to find comfort in the moon's presence? Here's Madison poet Lynn Patrick Smith.
Sleeping Over. At her house, I slept upstairs with my head by the window, so the moon could find me without rustling sheets on empty beds. The moon is maternal. She tells me stories, listens to mine, knows all of my secrets, doesn't repeat them. Or if she does, she changes my name and weaves my secrets into stories hard to unravel, like a mystery few can solve. Those that are able to find and follow all of the clues are like the moon they already knew.
Moonlight appears to be leaking through the cracks around your back door. Do not seal them. When the house is silent and you need to talk, this is where you will come to confide in someone. Turn off all of the lights. You will not want them listening in, for you know they burn with envy, and they will repeat everything that they hear whenever you come to confide in someone. As quietly as you can, without concealing anything, recall your most innocent moment. Now you are ready. Moonlight knows when it is needed. It will settle down in your kitchen, ready to listen, and to be trusted. Now you must do the same. All of this must be done when you confide in someone. In someone. In someone.
That was poet Lynn Patrick Smith. It may not be a wonder that poets are inspired by a full moon, but what happens when they're inspired by the same full moon? Esther Cameron recounts one such coincidence.
One day in the summer of 1973, a friend invited me to drive up north with him to visit Francis Hammerstrom, the naturalist and writer. We set out and arrived that afternoon and were met by a hale-looking, gray-haired woman in a plaid shirt and slacks. She led us into the house, an older house, spacious, with zero pretensions to decor, and yet with a certain grace, the house of a person who loved the out-of-doors. Our mutual friend must have told her that I wrote poetry, because she mentioned that she occasionally did the same and showed me a few poems. I especially liked one, which she told me was dedicated to a young man who was helping the Hammerstroms in their work with golden eagles. She said that when an eagle or other falcon molts, it is confined to a room called the mews. Before being released, it must have a pair of jesses or leather straps attached to its legs. The eagle is touchy coming out of the molt and has to be approached quietly. Here is her poem. Out of the Mews, for Seppi. I waited until the moon slipped her silvery body behind a cloud. Barefoot, I slid into the mews and spoke to my eagle, not very loud. In the deep of the night, the jesses you made my eagle moved on to each leg. No fright. Oh, beautiful night. Somehow it came out that this poem was written at the full moon in August of the previous year, 1972, and I realized that one of the poems I had with me was written during the same full moon. Mine was as follows. August moonrise for dawn. Whippoorwill calls from the corn. In the twilight, my brother stepped in amongst the cornstalks. The shadows clasped him, made him one with them. Larger than last month, the gold round moon is something removed from behind a saint's head. It stains faint clouds with liquefied dust. My brother moves behind me along the rise. The moon moves behind his head in my right eye. He says the burrows of darkness in green alfalfa are deer trails, says the air on the hills is warmer still from day, asks if I can focus the moon. I cannot. This thought beats at my head like owl's wings, that blinded my senses feel through his the cloth into which they are woven. These poems have more in common than the date. The dedication to a younger man, her student, my 11 years younger brother, the sense of a collaboration, an action or perception that needs both the speaker and the dedicatee in order to complete itself, and an atmosphere that is not just the atmosphere of any full moon night, but of that particular full moon. The discovery of this connection must have led to Frances showing me her children's book, Walk When the Moon is Full, which tells of the nature walks that she took with her two small children at each of the 13 full moons in the year. On one of these nights, the boy gets mad at his mother and burst out, "The Cory cat with the cobby tail walked straight into the salt blue sea with a spider nesting on the end of his nose. That's you." Frances assured me that, yes, her son had really said that. She said he had been 3 years old at the time. I was awestruck. Not Alexander Pope, the master of the insult, could have topped that outburst by a 3-year-old boy. On a few occasions since, I've seen striking poems produced by non-poets under pressure, as if poetry were not only an art, but a phenomenon of nature, an element, like underground water, waiting to burst forth from any of us when the rock is struck. And since the matching of those August moon poems, many things have reminded me that all of us drink from the same aquifer. Frances Hammerstrom died last fall. Under the August moon, her golden eagle still flies, as a sign to us to guard the air, the water, and the common springs of song. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Whether you view the moon as a man or a woman probably depends upon your heritage. He was Igaluk to the Eskimos, Talab in ancient Arabia, or even just the man in the moon to modern Americans. She was Luna to the Greeks, Nikal to the Phoenicians, and Mahina to the Hawaiians. Poet Fran Rawl thinks of the moon as a woman, but not quite a goddess.
The washerwoman. The washerwoman launders hearts in the moonlight. She scrubs and rinses, washing out the wild blood, exorcising ghostly memories. Trees shimmer in the liquid light, casting shadows that writhe across the grass. There, on their insubstantial limbs, draining ventricles hang, tidily turned inside out. This is Fran Rahl reporting from Mind's Eye Radio.
Stand outside in the moonlight on a warm summer evening, and you might just hear the music of the moon. It happened to so many composers, including Beethoven, Debussy, and Schoenberg. Here is classic music scholar Samantha Sheets to take us on a tour through some of the most famous moon music of all.
This first movement of a sonata by Beethoven, it's the sonata in C-sharp minor for piano, and it's much more well-known as the Moonlight Sonata. Beethoven actually didn't give the name Moonlight to this piece. It wasn't really conceived by the composer as some sort of a portrayal of the moon. But the title Moonlight is actually believed to come from a review made by Heinrich Rellstab. Upon hearing the first movement of the sonata, he commented that it was like, quote, a boat visiting by moonlight the primitive landscapes of Lake Lucerne in Switzerland, end quote. Well, this was composed right around the turn of the 19th century. And at this point, Beethoven is really changing from the classical period into the romantic style. And at this time also, he does become aware of his own impending deafness. It's kind of more a reflective type of music because it is kind of still and you know, supposedly this kind of primitive landscape of Lake Lucerne, this idea of stillness, and perhaps just somebody might be just sitting there reflecting on their own. A very unusual piece called Der Mondfleck. It comes from a set of songs by Arnold Schoenberg entitled Pierrot Lunaire. In this piece, the moonlight actually becomes a means through which he expresses his unconscious images. Some of the things are these images of giant bats and very gruesome scenes of beheading in the later movements of Pierrot Lunaire.
So spaziert Pierrot im blauen Abend auf zuchtigen Abenteuer. Plötzlich stört was.
Another technique that's used is a vocal technique called Sprechstimme, literally speaking voice in German. The use of the voice kind of falls in between speaking and singing, and it creates a very eerie character, similar to perhaps a chanting voice of someone that's very insane, someone you might call a lunatic. In contrast, there's another piece that's based on a poem by another French symbolist poet. The poet's name is Paul Verlaine, and the piece is Clair de Lune by Claude Debussy. Debussy here captures in sound the impressions of shimmering moonlight and a slow, dreamy music for a peaceful, clear night. French Impressionism really seeks to capture these momentary views of objects outside of oneself. It's not as interested as the inner world that Expressionism is. Like the poem, Debussy's setting for flute and orchestra provides the listener with impressions of moonlight, music, birds, and fountains through its descriptive language.
And finally, a warm summer night, a full moon, a little champagne. Does it spell magic and romance? Or just a memorable family event, as told in Franzel's short story, Piano Lessons?
After my piano recital, we gathered by the backyard picnic table in a beautiful, moonlit night. Daddy opened a bottle of Italian champagne he'd stashed in the refrigerator, Asti Spumanti. The cork made a magical popping sound and flew up toward the stars. "Thar she blows," David announced, following its white arc into the clear sky. "Thar she blows." We'd seen the movie Moby Dick that spring, and both David and my father loved to use that phrase at every opportunity. "Do you really think the kids ought to drink that?" Mommy ran a worried hand through her hair, as Daddy began filling all four fluted glasses he'd carried out from the dining room hutch. "It's a special occasion, Leah," Daddy reassured her. "How often does my daughter play a Haydn sonata in front of 100 people? Anyway, they're going to try alcohol sooner or later. They might as well learn to handle it at home." Daddy sometimes made kitty cocktails for David and me, and we'd gulp them with the same sort of childish gusto with which we used to approach candy cigarettes. But champagne, actual champagne. Once I'd begged the olive from Mommy's martini, but it tasted horrible, bitter and perfumey, and made me wonder exactly who my mother was that she smacked her lips over the same flavors. "To the family," Daddy spoke solemnly, standing before us with his glass raised high. "To the family," David squealed, knocking my glass so enthusiastically I nearly dropped it. "To the family," I clanked David's glass back, the both of us breaking up at the notion of toasting each other. "Sip it slowly now, kids," Mommy warned, delicately clinking her glass against mine, then Daddy's and David's. But slowly was not a word I could associate with champagne, not after one, two, then many more acquaintances with its delightful wet fizz. David guzzled it like it was a kitty cocktail, wiping the back of his hand across his mouth with a satisfied sigh.
I see the cork, he shouted suddenly, pointing at the sky. I see the cork. It wasn't the cork, of course. It was the North Star. But David didn't care. He danced around the yard like a little jumping bean, singing at the top of his lungs. My dad's a corker. He's a New Yorker. No, David, I bumped him with my glass, slashing champagne over both of us. There's the cork. There's the real cork. I waved a dramatic hand at the moon, which smirked, large and nearly full, over all of us. By the light of the silvery cork, I blurted out, and Daddy joined in. Then Mommy and David, all of us substituting a lot of la-di-da-di-das where we didn't know the real words. Carolina cork! Mommy launched us, off-key, into another fractured song, sidling up close to Daddy, while David and I sashayed over to the picnic table to refill our glasses. Row, row, row your cork gently down the stream. David was getting really silly, but it didn't matter. We all joined forces, our voices rising above insect choruses, rustling leaves, even the steady whoosh of cars traveling north and south along Coventry Road, just beyond our hedges. We sang until long after we'd emptied the bottle of champagne and the moon had belly-flopped over neighbors' rooftops, leaving us in darkness, except for a sliver of light from our kitchen window. This is Fran Zell for Mind's Eye Radio.
Piano Lessons is one of 10 stories written by Fran Zell about the character Marcy Rosen and published by Keylog Press. You've been listening to Moonglow, written by members of the Mind's Eye Radio Collective in Madison, Wisconsin. The show is produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Sue Renard. Contributing writers include Esther Cameron, Gay Davidson Zilski, Charlotte Quo Benitez, Christian Newhouse, Dick Radke, Fran Rahl, Sue Renard, Lynn Patrick Smith, Mark James von Karstedt, Greg Willard, Jackie Wilson, and Fran Zell. The Mind's Eye players included Christian Newhouse, Sue Renard, Claire Radke, Dick Radke, Eric Rasmussen, and Marianne Rasmussen. Thanks to Alex Zilski and Lucas Brogan for their homemade rocket-launching sound effects. Original music by Barbara Chusett. If you would like a copy of this show or would like more information about Mind's Eye Radio, call 608-256-6525. Or check out our website at www.mindseyeaudio.com. That's mindseyeaudio, all one word and no apostrophe, .com. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Cole Hornaday. There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
Okay, Sue, here's your challenge. Sing as many moon songs as you can in 30 seconds.
It must have been moon glow, moon over Miami.
I suppose you're wondering why I have my friend Sue here singing moon songs. She's just helping me promote Moon Glow, the next Mind's Eye radio program. We'll relive Neil Armstrong's famous One Small Step and hear about a Chinese princess who may have been there first. That's Moon Glow on Mind's Eye Radio. It's radio within reach.
I'll